your host for Lacrosse Talk PM, Rick Sola.
All right, welcome to a Thursday of Lacrosse Talk PM. Want to get in here? Now's the time to do it. Just want to, what does he say, have something to complain about? Here would be a good time to do it. 608-785-7914. Coming up on the show, I'm going to have, this is going to be up my alley, and I'm just trying to make it up your alley, but I'm going to have an ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR on, and we're going to talk about how, talk about something that he found in the woods that hasn't been seen here in Wisconsin in half a century or over a half a century. It's pretty interesting. It's not something like completely out of the ordinary, but when you find something that hasn't been around in over 50 years, it's pretty crazy. I think we can also go down an avenue here of talking about, because he's an ecologist, he's so essentially the natural world that we're living in, and talk about how everything is affecting everything else and maybe what we can and can't do about that. Just how we go about, making the land around us better to make our lives better, and the water around us better, right? Like that's kind of I think that fight's probably not too far down the road, probably in our lifetimes, where water is going to be pretty important, and not that we're going to get into that conversation. We could get into that conversation tomorrow. 608-785-7914 is the talk and text line. Had a pretty good conversation yesterday with La Crosse County District Attorney Tim Grinke. So if you want to listen to that, go to wisdomnews.com. You can find all these shows under the podcast tab, all Hayes' interviews. There's Bill Feehan's podcast called Fact Check, Ken Cooper's Around River City, and William Garcia, the La Crosse County. Well, Bill Feehan's the Democrat, or the Democratic, the Republican Party chair of La Crosse County, and then William Garcia's the Democratic Voice podcast. He's the other side of that, the Democratic Party chair of La Crosse County. So you can find all those up there. And I think William and I were going to talk about something. Now I forgot. I just blinked on what we're going to talk about. On Monday's podcast that you'll be able to hear. Oh, infrastructure. The Senate it's kind of like dueling pianos in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate right now, dueling pianos where they're trying to pass one infrastructure bill and also another bigger infrastructure bill. And they're like in the trillions, which is always funny to me how we kind of summarize what we're trying to do in the Senate. Hey, we're going to pass this $1.5 trillion infrastructure bill. Also, we're going to pass this $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. And in my head, I'm like, $1.5 trillion or $1.5 trillion dollar infrastructure bill. We abbreviate trillions now, like it's a NBA salary when LeBron James signs for $20.2 million. You know, the $200,000, meh. And now it's the $500 billion. Meh, whatever. It's always kind of interesting how we do that. It's easy to write, but it wears that. It just lessens the scope of what we're doing. Not that we don't need to do it. I think a lot of times we're just passing the buck down to the next administration and blaming the previous administration for not doing the thing that we should all be doing, which is updating all this crap. You can see it in town, right? You can see it on La Crosse Street. Right. You could just, we can cry about it every day. Fix the roads. Like we do that every day, right? Anything that the city wants to do that isn't fixing the roads, there's always somebody that points to, hey, why aren't we fixing the roads? And if you drive around town, man, we're really fixing the roads, aren't we? It's super fun to have to go through downtown to get to work instead of driving in front of the La Crosse Center. Super fun. If you haven't noticed, the La Crosse Center all in front of there is under construction. Huge cement, I don't know, pipes, sewers. I mean, are we upgrading the sewer in front of the La Crosse Center right now, maybe? So that's going on. Right before 5 o'clock, Ace texted in a multiple car accident between the ramps on Highway 53 and on Alaska. So between the ramps, huge traffic jam, several emergency vehicles That was Highway 53 North. So Highway 53 North. That was, he sent that to me 13 minutes ago. So just warning you, could be a huge traffic jam 13 minutes ago. It's probably still backed up if you're traveling home, which a lot of people I think are. I tried to get the La Crosse police to come on one of these days. I had a pretty fun show idea in mind. And maybe I'll just ask a different police department, because I just wanted to have a fun conversation with police about some of the things going on and just some of the stuff that happens in social media and some of the updates that police are having, the new body cam, stuff like that. I just want to have a general conversation about that stuff. And nothing really specific. Like the community resource unit I wanted to talk about, where we're bringing like a, you know, perhaps a mental health professional along on a call with a police officer to, you know, better assess the situation. We talked to Fire Chief Ken Gilliam a couple weeks ago, and part of that conversation was about the health and physical training of firemen, firewomen, fire people. And so I thought, hey, police, can we talk about that a little bit? And then there's a lot of posts on social media that are kind of funny. There's the parking page on Facebook that so I wanted to just snipe some of the weird things that people post on social media that are happening in the town, and I wanted to show the police and be like, hey, how would you assess this? And nothing somewhat specific, but we didn't have to get into details. It would have been fun, and we could have talked about, you know, serious stuff and have fun. And the reply I got was, thanks for reaching out. I hope all is going well. No one is available to connect on the below. Nobody in the department can have fun, apparently. So there's that. So when you want to talk to the police about body cams, when you want to talk to the police about the new community resource unit, you want to talk about to the police about physical health training, when you want to talk to the police about vehicle training, I mentioned that, high speed chase training, like how does that work? Just how does it work with police, you know, in that regard? And then just some stuff that happens on social media in our town that a lot of people see and talk about. And can we have some fun with that? And again, thanks for reaching out. Hope all is going well. No one is available to connect on the below. So thanks for that. All right. I'm going to get Ryan O'Connor here, ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. We're going to talk about this very rare find that he found in Wisconsin. And we're just going to talk about ecology and how, you know, it's affecting us when we come back. All right, welcome back to La Crosse Talk PM, 608-785-7914. We're just going to make it the text line for right now. If you have questions about, how would we say this, Ryan, about the land, sea, and the air, just text them in. You got the answers, Ryan?
Absolutely, Rick.
Well, that's Ryan O'Connor. He's the ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. Ryan, you said you've been with the DNR maybe in this position for about 10 years, but your little bio says you're 20th year conducting rare species inventories is what this says, and you've been with the DNR doing that for 13 years. How does one get into, you know what I want to do? I want to walk, I don't know. Do you walk around the woods looking for things that can't be found all day? Is that what you do?
not exactly. Part of our role, there's a couple of us that are statewide ecologists with the DNR, and we try to support sound management practices on DNR-owned properties. And so to that end, we go out and do field surveys, or what we call field inventories of state lands. And, you know, we're really looking for, you know, sort of high quality forests and prairies and wetlands, you know, sites that have a lot of different kinds of plants and animals that are there. Places that don't have a lot of invasive species problems, and then we try to get the correct management, you know, the best management on those areas.
I live just over the river in Minnesota, so in my area where I'm at, I'm on a bluff. They've brought goats in to eat the invasive species so that we can repopulate the rattlesnake population. I imagine that's something we're probably doing in the La Crosse area. Are you pro-rattlesnake then, too?
Well, you know, I'm pro all species. You know, all species are important, you know, to the heritage of Wisconsin. You know, our forebears, you know, sort of came and settled this landscape, and you know, the areas that were that these bluffs, you know, that the first settlers, you know, to encounter this areas and Native Americans that lived here before, a lot of these bluffs were wide open, you know, and they were wide open for hundreds or thousands of years. So very few trees, you know, there are certain trees sort of like deeper in the ravines and in the floodplains, but on the bluffs themselves, it was really wide open. And, you know, and we had lots of different kinds of wildflowers and grasses and butterflies. And yes, some rattlesnakes, you know, sort of utilizing these areas, but so much has been lost that, you know, scientists estimate that less than 1% of our prairies remain, you know, which makes them more rare than tropical rainforests. You know, so things like goats eating the brush is a great thing. And the rattlesnakes usually keep to themselves. But if you do happen to see one, just don't try to pick it up.
Yeah, I saw one. You'll probably be fine. I saw one for the first time the other day, and I was like, oh, good. He's kind of in my driveway and below my retaining wall, so there was really no place for him to go. I don't know if he can climb a retaining wall or not. That's made of like railroad tiles. But so I was like, okay, dogs, let's go in the house. And you know, like 20 minutes later, I went to just kind of check, and he was gone. So it was good. I don't know if it was a he, but I just imagine. But yeah, I didn't care about that until I saw a rattlesnake. I was like, man, if my dogs would have just walked right over that spot, it might have been kind of a disaster. But I understand the idea there. In what you had found, and we'll get to that in a minute, but in the story that I read, and you mentioned 1% of prairie land, we're down to 1%. That seems just crazy. But another stat that I saw, fully 75% of wildlife species listed in Wisconsin is threatened or endangered, and 90% of state-listed plants are supported. So are we down to like 75% of every species is threatened or endangered? Is that the right stat?
Well, yeah, no, I think, yeah, those numbers that you read refer to the percent of rare species that are found on state natural areas. And I'm glad you asked about state natural areas. Wisconsin has the oldest and largest state natural area program in the nation. It got started actually 70 years ago. In 1951, and Wisconsin was the first state in the nation where they conceived of this idea of a collection of preserves, basically, that were going to be set aside and managed for the conservation, you know, of Wisconsin's native landscapes. So it's 70th year of the state natural area program, and you know, and there are a lot on land owned by the state of Wisconsin by the DNR, but it's also a network of over 60 partner organizations. So there's even private landowners that voluntarily say, like, I'm really proud of my site; it's really important, and I want my land to be recognized, you know, as part of this program. And within that collection of these 700, you know, or so state natural areas, they support 90% of the plant species that are listed as rare.
Okay.
And of the animals that are rare, fully 75% of those or more. So
is a state natural area?
That's where those numbers came from.
Yeah, is a state natural area, is that kind of unique to Wisconsin? I imagine other places do it and call it something else, but. And is there a better way to preserve the land and the ecosystems than this way? Those 60 private owners, do they sign off on like a 10-year deal, and then 10 years maybe I'll put my house up?
Yeah, there are lots of other examples of state natural areas in other parts of the nation. You know, Michigan has some. I think Minnesota may have some. You know, and so, yeah, sometimes they call them different things. They might not always call them, you know, a state natural area, but they are effectively the same thing. But there, you know, there's lots of different ways that land can be protected, you know, appropriately. You know, there's local land trusts and nonprofits like in your area, the Mississippi Valley Conservancy, does terrific work, and they own, you know, some property. They also work directly with private landowners to get a conservation easement, you know, on their property, so that landowner, you know, continues to own the property, continues to have, retain their property rights, you know, and then they come to an agreement on what they want to do, you know, in terms of conserving the prairie, you know, the bluff prairie that's adjacent to them.
And a state natural area.
For conservation easements and for a state natural areas, that's envisioned to be a long-term thing.
So. Is there a state natural area? Is it just essentially we're not going to touch it? We're essentially going to leave it or get it to where it's most natural and then we're not going to touch it? Is that how that works?
You know, that used to be the old way of thinking, but we've been finding there's, you know, I think this has been known for a while, but there's also recent research that has confirmed it, that we, you know, we have to be actively stewarding, you know, these areas. We have to be checking for invasive species and removing them. For prairies and savannas, we have to be, you know, conducting prescribed burns. And sort of without that careful tending, without that stewardship, without that management, a lot of these sites start to go downhill and are really suffering. And a lot of them, you know, a lot of them really need a lot of help. So.
And
that's what we try to do.
We're speaking with Ryan O'Connor. He's an ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. We were talking about rattlesnakes. I got a text. Why do we need to repopulate rattlesnakes? Because they do not like snakes. This texter didn't.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of you know, opinion in terms of, yeah, what the goal is. You know, our goal, you know, tries to be maintaining the original wealth and variety of species that occur in the state, you know. So I would say we're trying to like repopulate them in terms of like spread them to new areas, you know. Like no one's going to like pick a rattlesnake up and try to like reestablish it, you know, on someone's property. But we do, you know, sort of have a responsibility, and you know, but both in state statute, but I would also say like as an ethical or moral responsibility to try to perpetuate those species, you know, in the unique habitats where they do occur.
Yeah, there's also the food pyramid, right? The snake lives on that food pyramid at some point. So whatever's above it is needed, and below the snake is needed. Otherwise, if you take something out, they're trying to do that in Florida, right? They're trying to eliminate essentially the mosquito, and some people are worried that if you eliminate the mosquito, then what happens to the rest of that pyramid?
Sure. Yeah, it's another way to think about it.
All right, so Ryan, I want to talk to you about what is called, and we get into this. I got to take a break here, but we'll do the radio tease, Ryan. The green violet, what you found, this plant, is it the holy grail of plants, or there's a whole bunch of holy grail plants, and this is one of them? How do we describe the Hibanthus concolor?
Yeah, that's right. Green violet, Hibanthus concolor. I would put it on a short list of plants that could be in a holy grail category where people have been looking for them for a long time. But this one is probably at the top and sort of had the most, almost like a mythology about it.
If there was a college football ranking of plant finds in Wisconsin, is this the number one?
Certainly of the year, you know, and that's not by my own judging, you know, so possibly of the decade, you know, but we always hope for other really interesting things to be found. And if someone can top it, that would be awesome. You know, we need more people out there looking for interesting things and reporting them to experts so they could be verified and continue building our knowledge of what's really here in the state.
I think the analogy is flawed, though, Ryan. If we call it the holy grail of plants, it can only be one plant. There's only one holy grail I don't know. Maybe did Jesus have a bunch of holy grails, and we're trying to find a whole bunch of them? I'm guessing that there's only one holy grail. So we need a better analogy. This is one of the top 10 plant. You know what I mean? I'm just messing with you.
Yeah, no, but you haven't seen Monty. You know, have you seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Yes.
I mean, you know, there's you know, they come up to the castle, and another group says they already got one.
Yeah. So yeah, right.
I'm messing with your back. So.
Yeah, yeah. I spit in your general direction, Ryan. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Ryan's Holy Grail of plants that he found hasn't been found since 1958 in Wisconsin. Did he almost step on it? We'll find out when we come back. All right, welcome back to Lacrosse Talk PM. 608-785-7914 is the talk and text line if you want to get in here. Ryan O'Connor, he's an ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. He's on the phone with me. We've been talking about state natural areas, and we're going to talk about the holy grail of plants he found. But first of all, Ryan, you off the air here, you said state natural areas in Wisconsin, they don't have hiking trails or anything like that. When you're watching a movie and there's like a chase scene through the woods, and people just seem to have no trouble running through the woods, do you, as an ecologist that's kind of in the woods quite a bit, just get mad and go, God, this is unrealistic, because they would be tripping over everything trying to get through these woods?
you definitely have to watch where you walk. But there is some art and skill to walking through the woods. We do hike off trail a lot, and it is, you know, so you're navigating, you know, with a GPS unit and digital maps and sometimes paper maps, a handheld compass. We still use those. And you're kind of battling, you know, poison ivy and ticks and mosquitoes and horseflies, like, all while trying to take stock and evaluate it. Like, what's the quality of this forest? Am I seeing any invasive species? Am I keeping my eye out for rare plants? So,
yeah. How many pairs of, like, hiking boots do you go through a year then? Quite a few?
You usually get one pair to get me through two seasons. So, all right. Yeah, more than your average person.
And when you all go, do you go out in partners? Because if you happen to just fall in the woods, nobody's going to be there, and you might not get salt. Do you have to go out in like a team?
You know, we do sometimes go out in a team, but I would say more often than that, we're working on our own. And, you know, some of that is to cover more ground, and some of that is because we don't have a lot of capacity. You know, there are about two and a half people who really specialize in rare plants and ecosystems who do field surveys, you know, across the state. So, you know, that breaks down to about, you know, like 10 million acres a person. And so we just, you know, for efficiency's sake, we have to split up so we can cover more ground.
Is that a state problem, or is that there's just not enough people interested in this and that are graduating with degrees that want to memorize all the plants in the world?
You know, there has been a drop off of people, in botanical programs to somewhat. But I think more it's an issue of, it's just a tough thing to try to justify funding for, you know, at the state level. Mm-hmm. We do get a lot of support from grants. We have a lot of support from donors, you know, but certainly, like, unlike a lot of, you know, positions and or programs in the DNR, like, the majority of our funding actually doesn't come, you know, directly from, like, state revenue, you know, earmarks. A lot of it's from grants and if people like to support our work, you can do it via the tax checkoff at tax season, or you can buy an eagle plate for your vehicle. And, $25 of that, you know, comes back to our program, and then it's matched, you know, by the state. But then often that $50 is then often used to match other, like, state and federal grants.
Okay.
That $25 might turn into $100.
I put you in a don't get fired question there. Sorry, Ryan.
Fine.
No, it's all good. Okay. So when I asked you about just going out in teams or alone, I'm assuming somewhere between here and Eau Claire, you were out alone. And before you went out on this day in May, your daughter wrote you a letter or a little note. I guess she's 6 years old? And she said, is she six? Was she six at the time, Ryan?
Yeah, she was six and in kindergarten and just kind of learning to write and stuff. And she said, threw me a little note and put it in my overnight bag and said, "Dear Dad, I hope you find lots of rare stuff."
All right, now.
And it turned out to be the good luck charm that I needed. And that was the day that I found the rare plant.
How was her penmanship on this note? Was it one of those when kindergartens write, it's the two lines and then the dashed line down the middle? So she's got, it's a really big note, actually. Like, physically,
it's definitely a keeper. It's definitely a cute note.
was there any R's or D's backwards on the note? Anything like that? Any letters that she's going to have to work on?
No, she's pretty good. They do a good job at her school. So obviously
that note's awesome. I hope you find lots of rare stuff. And here you find what we're calling the holy grail of plants: the green violet, Hibanthus concolor. Did you step on it? Like, how do you recognize this thing that we haven't seen in the state since 1958? Or is this a thing that you're very in tune to recognizing because it's something you're looking for? I have no idea how that works.
You know, we are. We're always looking for things that are different. You know, I think it's like when you start to do a job for a long time, you start to recognize the things that are normal that you see all the time. And you know, whether you're a farmer or a doctor, or somebody who works in the service industry, when something sort of just like looks different or feels different, you know, it sort of piques your interest, you know, a little bit. And that's what kind of happens, you know, when we're walking through the woods and see something interesting, you know. So in this case, it was early May. I was walking through this beautiful maple and oak forest, and there's lots of spring wildflowers, you know, all around. And I looked up and I saw this plant that I knew I just didn't recognize at a distance. And so I decided to go over and check it out. And when I got up to it, I realized that it was green violet. And you know, I had seen it twice about 15 years ago when we used to work in Michigan. I'm originally from Michigan and worked in a similar capacity there for a number of years. And so even though I hadn't seen it for a long time, you know, it's distinctive enough that I knew right away, you know, what it was. So I started taking a bunch of pictures, and I did, you know, sort of, I did want to confirm with other professional colleagues to make sure that I had the identification correct, and that it, you know, it couldn't be something else. But they wrote back really quickly and said, yeah, that's it. Wow, nice find.
But you're out in the middle of the woods. There's nobody to talk to. This is your job. This is like like you said, the holy grail of finds. So are you like giddy and screaming like a school kid? Or are you, and do you have cell reception where you can tell somebody, or do you have to get, because I think the story said you might not have had cell reception. So you're just out in the woods, you know, excited that you found this thing, but you can't tell anybody at this point except, you know, maybe a squirrel or something.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, there's definitely an excitement, you know, that comes, you know, and it's particularly with this instance, you know, it was really, you know, sort of like pretty humbling, you know, because it was on a site that it probably would have been found by somebody at some point, but you know, somehow I was the one who was fortunate enough to sort of be there at the right time. And, you know, and that just sort of feels like a real honor. You know, it's sort of like kind of a once in a career, once in a lifetime, you know, kind of experience. So it was pretty neat.
How quickly do you realize what you found, or did you wait for confirmation before you let yourself get too excited?
I would say I was 99% sure right off the bat, but I wanted to like just double and triple check, you know. So we work with colleagues at the University of Wisconsin Herbarium, and I emailed them some photos, and I emailed our state botanist who's a friend and colleague of mine, and he wrote back right away to say like, wow, like that's definitely it, that's amazing.
Now we haven't really described the plant because we're on radio, obviously, and I googled green violet. Ryan, if I saw this in my flower garden, I'd probably pull it up as a weed.
Well, you're unlikely to have it, find it in a flower garden, but it is interesting, and you know, it's related, you know, technically to violets, but it really doesn't look that much like a violet. Its name Hybanthus comes from the tendency of the flowers to actually dangle down underneath the leaves. So it stands, you know, 12 inches tall or so. And, you know, and its scientific name actually means like humpbacked flower, because the flower sort of like, you know, arches up and then down, kind of hanging right underneath the leaves. And all the flower is green, like the petals are green, the sepals are green. And so color means all the same color.
Yeah, I would say.
And that's kind of how it gets the same.
I would say, I guess if this is your job and you saw this thing, it is kind of unique because the it has these tiny little flowers that almost look like they're growing off the stem, and then leaves grow from the stem as well that are quite a bit bigger. So it is kind of a unique looking plant. I am going to go. I live in the woods, Ryan, so I have a unique perspective that, you know, people that living in La Crosse, they're just not. I might have one of these in my yard. I'm going to go look tomorrow, and then I'll text you if I find one.
Well, yeah, it is known from three places in Minnesota. So yeah, you could have the fourth.
So what do you do when you find this thing? Do you have, like, are you just carrying tomato cages around and you just put a bunch of tomato cages around it so nobody steps on the thing?
You know, in this instance, there was actually quite a few. It was growing there by the hundreds, which made it even more amazing, you know, that it was there, you know, sort of like doing its thing for probably for decades without being found. But you know, typically we, you know, it just kind of elevates that site in terms of like how it's managed, and it'll get extra attention, you know, from, I would say the primary concerns for this one are, in making sure that there's not invasive species that are overtaking the site, making sure that it doesn't have excessive like logging or grazing, you know. Now in this case, like it's on a state property, so grazing, you know, by livestock or something like that really isn't an issue. But that did do in the only other known site in the state. It was sort of logged and grazed hard in the 60s, and they think that's why it vanished. But you know, we usually don't put cages around things, but we do try to maintain the habitat and protect the features that allow the thing to be there and thrive in the first place.
I don't know if tomato cages are going to do it. My friend has cows, and the cows got out of the pasture and into her garden, and then she sent me a picture of a cow with a tomato cage around its head. So I imagine if deer eat this thing, a tomato cage isn't going to stop it.
Yeah. You know, some people do cage orchids. There are some extremely rare orchids, and as they are trying to flower and set fruit, you know, when they find them, they'll try to cage with, like, you know, sort of a little more robust, like chicken wire or something like that. And that actually, you know, for a small number of species, that turns out to be kind of important, but probably not for green violet that we know of.
Okay. Well, you talk about this being a holy grail of plant finds, and it's so rare, but you said it's thriving. Do you essentially then, I'll just go one at a time here. Do you just leave it alone because it's doing so well?
You know, there has been talk, you know, we'll probably leave it alone at this site. You know, it seems to be doing well enough on its own. And our job in this case is to really just kind of let it keep doing its thing. You know, so we'll definitely monitor the site regularly for things like garlic mustard, you know, that might come in. You know, we encourage hikers when they come into woods or other natural areas to, like, kind of scrub any excess dirt off their boots, because that's how seeds get introduced. It can also bring in non-native earthworms. A lot of people have heard of jumping worms, but actually all species of earthworms are not native to the state, and they can really destroy the leaf litter layer that some of our plants need to survive. And a species like green violet, actually, the seeds are dispersed by ants. And so the ants need a place to live, you know, so both in the litter and in the soil itself.
So you just throw a donut down to attract some ants then? Is that what you did?
Yeah. I suppose you could.
And then, like, okay, so you leave it alone, but do you take a sample, or do you pull some up so you can go, and do you take it and plant it elsewhere because it's so rare and we want it? Do we want to plant it elsewhere so it thrives, so we bring it back a little bit?
You know, yeah, that's a great point. You know, for species that are in this really rare category where there's only one or two sites known in the state, or where the populations are really small and they think that, you know, there might just not be enough of them to perpetuate, you know, the gene pool, so to speak. You know, we do try to collect seeds and, you know, with a long-term plan of trying to perhaps germinate them in a greenhouse, or plant those seeds at another area. Sometimes they'll try to cross-pollinate plants from one location to another to increase genetic diversity. But the focus is always on, you know, sort of first conserving the site, you know, where they're known from. But in the case of green violet, we are sort of in the process of working with a group in Minnesota who's also working on conservation of their green violet populations, and they reach out to us. They said, hey, are you interested in joining us and also partnering? And we said, sure, yeah, that sounds great. So we're going to work with them and collecting seeds, and then potentially, you know, trying to germinate them. And then it becomes a discussion of, like, where else would be good, you know, areas to try to plant new populations.
Yeah, because this hasn't been found in Wisconsin. You found it for the first time since 1958. In Minnesota, if they have, you know, maybe it's rare in Minnesota, but they've been working on it, they're probably like a little bit ahead of the game. And how, I mean, I'm guessing germinating seeds is pretty universal. Each plant, you know, different plants want to do it different ways. But these guys in Minnesota are probably a little ahead that they can just go, oh, yeah, here. And also, Ryan, do you need to germinate seeds from different populations? Is that the key there? We don't want, like, the same plants in the same area to repopulate?
You know, I'm obviously, if you're doing that work, genetic diversity is really important. So, you know, we haven't done a lot of that historically, but it's something that we'd like to do more of, and we think it's probably important for some of our rarest species.
Okay, I'm getting a text here from Sparky. He says, what's the best way to deal with garlic mustard? He lives in the woods, and he says it's taking over where he's at.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, garlic mustard is an interesting one because it spreads really rapidly, but it also has some properties that make it controllable. You know, if you have a small population, you can try to pull it by hand in the spring. If it's bigger, some people have also found success conducting a prescribed burn, especially if it's in like an oak woods. And if you have enough oak litter to carry a fire, that fire, you know, if it's warm enough, will sort of torch the green rosettes that sort of green up in the fall instead of stay green all winter. And those are the plants that are getting ready to flower the next year. And so if you can set some of those back, you know, you'll have a lower population to deal with then. And the final thing people can do if it's really, really dense and there's not much that they're worried about killing is that you can use, you know, an herbicide on the green rosettes that will kill them. And, you know, especially if it's really dense, there's low risk of damaging non-target plants. But that's usually a last resort. But, yeah, it does need to be, I think the key is sort of a long-term control. You know, you need, you know, 5-6, you know, a 10-year effort, you know, to sort of try to bring it back under control. So all right. It takes persistence.
Ryan, I'm getting a call here. We'll see what Jim, do you have a question for Ryan?
Yeah, I was just calling about garlic mustard. He was answering the question, but I have a question about this, what he was just talking about, like if I can use a torch on an area.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you could use sort of like a blowtorch or like a sometimes they have like a propane tank, you know, with a flame wand on it. You know, that will certainly work to scorch those green rosettes. You know, you just want to be sure that you're doing it at a time when there's, you know, low risk of wildfire. You know, but like, you know, an early wet spring day, you know, when it's real damp outside or even when it's like a little bit drizzly is a perfect time to do that. Even when there's snow in patches, you'll still be able to see those green rosettes.
Don't get fired, Ryan. Ryan, don't get fired. You're going to have people torching everywhere. There's going to be blow torches. Everyone's going to be torching. No, but When you talk about the DNR and doing control burns, if somebody live like I live in Minnesota, but if I live in the woods, would the DNR come and control burn? Like my backyard is like a state scientific forest area, but does the DNR do that, or do you have to hire like a private company to do that?
Yeah, the DNR is kind of has its hands full trying to do its own burns on its own property, and you know, sort of difficulty keeping up with that on its own. But you certainly can reach out to private contractors and just, you know, you need to make sure that they have expertise in doing that and carry the right kind of liability insurance and things like that. But there are a lot of good contractors out there who are really well qualified and who are really experts at this stuff. And, you know, they visit your property and they develop a burn plan, you know, which is based on what type of fuels you have, is it grass or leaves or how much brush is there, the topography, what kind of winds, you know, direction and wind speed, you know, is appropriate and tolerable to make sure the fire will carry, but that it won't carry too much.
All right, Ryan O'Connor, he's an ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. He found the holy grail of plants in Wisconsin. The green violet hasn't been here since 1958. We mentioned, Ryan, that your daughter, before you went out in that day in May, she wrote you a note. It said, Dear Dad, and I'm picturing she's in kindergarten, so it's on that big lined paper with the dashes down the middle of the line. Dear Dad, I hope you find lots of rare stuff, which you did. You found the holy grail of plants. You got back home that day. I buried the best question. What did you, what your daughter's reaction? Did you show her a picture? Did she even care?
You know, she kind of has a muted response sometimes, but she did get like a big silent smile across her face. When it hit the news, she was like, "You mean I'm famous?" You know, so she was pretty excited about that.
Any notes since then? Has there been any? Is she writing a note every day now?
You know, it's kind of tailed off a little bit. That must mean why I haven't found anything super, super exciting lately.
All right. It's up to her. What's her name? We got to get her to we should just entice her to encourage you to find more rare stuff.
Yeah, her name is Sophia.
All right, Sophia, let's get another note for Dad so that she can find some more race stuff. Hey, Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
All right, see ya. That's Ryan O'Connor. He's been he's an ecologist with Wisconsin DNR, been with the DNR conducting rare species inventories for 20 years, 13 in Wisconsin here. All right, one quick break. We'll be back to wrap up. All right, that's pretty much going to wrap it up for today. Thanks to Ryan O'Connor for joining us for most of the show. Appreciate that. Tried to make the most of talking about plants. Something that I'm kind of into, just kind of into nature in general. Not that I'm always the best to nature, driving my 96 F-150 around right now. I don't know. I thought it was pretty enjoyable for a talk about plants, right? But there's some interesting facts that are in the idea that, you know, he finds this thing that hasn't been found in 50 years in Wisconsin. And now what do you do with it? And it sounds like they kind of just leave it alone, but also they'll propagate it and maybe start to think about, they just found it in May. So, but winter's coming, right? So what do we do? Up until then, you got to preserve it and maybe repopulate it in other places. Sounds like it's not quite as rare here in Minnesota, over in Minnesota. So they're going to work with people in Minnesota. Coming up tomorrow, I don't know. Tregoski's on vacation, so I don't have Tregoski to come in here and goof around with. I have some stuff that I wanted to talk about. There's a big asteroid coming, could destroy the Earth. I threw that in my Friday notes. I do this. I just save links, and then that's what I want to talk about. We'll see.